And our next case this morning is case number 101518, United States versus, is it Bozier? All right. Mr. Eller.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Joshua Euler, and I am the attorney for the defendant appellant, Edward Bozier. In this case, Mr. Bozier challenges the district court's finding that he is not entitled to a two-level reduction in his offense level for being a minor participant in the fraud scheme with which he was convicted of being a member. As a preliminary matter, Mr. Bozier does not argue that the sentence imposed in this case was substantively unreasonable. Rather, the court imposed a guideline sentence, and Mr. Bozier's argument is that the court erred in calculating the appropriate sentencing guideline range. As the court knows, Section 3B1.2 of the United States Sentencing Guidelines allows a court to reduce a defendant's offense level by two levels if that defendant was a minor participant in the criminal conduct. Mr. Bozier does not suggest that he was not involved in this fraud scheme with his wife. By its definition, all minor participants and minimal participants are, in fact, participants of the...
Was he present when they made the first approach to the Pewaukee nuns?
He was, Judge.
He was there?
He was present.
Did he say anything?
I'm not certain if he made the representations or his wife made the representations. The victim of... the Pewaukee nuns, indicated that it was... always Miss Martin Mulu, Mr. Bozier's wife, who was making the representations and directing, I take that back, not making all the representations, but instructing how the money should be given. She was always the one contacting the monastery.
Yeah, but in that case, at least, he was present.
He was present.
Where was he when they're spending all this $1 million that they... found out from the nuns and the priests?
It's unclear if he was present with his wife all the time or some of the time. Mr. Bozier's assertion at the sentencing hearing was that his wife often went to the casinos without him. And
so he didn't know where... he had to know where this money was coming from and where it was going. He had to be part of this. And living as part of it.
He did know the money that he knew where it was coming from.
The gambling joints? I mean, they gambled it all away or spent it.
Almost all of it was gambled, that's correct.
Yeah, $1.1 million or something.
Close to that, yes.
Yeah. So he wants to be a minor participant. And she gets 41 months and he gets 39?
Correct. But the trial court's... statement on why his sentence was lower than hers had nothing to do with his role in the offense, but had more to do with his allocution and accepting, as the trial court determined it, more responsibility than his wife.
What part of the time was he present in the automobile? Did he drive her to these rendezvous or whatever they were?
It's tough to say how frequently he was her driver. And the frequency with which he accompanied her. It's safe to say that the majority of the visits, he did accompany his wife in the vehicle. And I think as the briefs in this case have laid forth, there really are two issues or two questions that would have to be answered in the affirmative for Mr. Bozier to be entitled to this reduction. First, was he less culpable than the average participant? And second, was his
now,
role...
Now, what are we going to do with this average person standard here? There isn't any average person. There are only two people involved.
Well,
are we hypothetical average person? Is that what we ought to...
The court, I think, appropriately compared Mr. Bozier's conduct to his wife's. The government has suggested that there can't be an average participant in a two-person fraud scheme or a two-person conspiracy.
She was certainly above average.
Well,
if she's able to constantly go back to these nuns and priests and continue to con them out of this huge amount of money.
And
based on some alleged illness, et cetera, he stays in the car being, I guess, because he can't get out. You know, he's disabled and whatever she's telling them. She's obviously, unfortunately, good at what she does.
And
maybe she didn't want him around to goof it up.
Well, of course, she would have to be the average participant for him to be less involved than the average participant. And as to the times when he remained in the vehicle, the government's assertion that that was part of the ruse requires them to know that he was aware as about the representations that were being made.
Of course he was. If he wasn't, he wouldn't have been guilty. The point is that they cooked up this scheme together. They carried out the scheme together. They played different roles in the scheme in terms of, you know, what they were conveying to the nuns to get them to cough up $1 million. And so there just can't be much difference, if any difference, in their culpability here. They did this together. They carried it out together. You know, she was the front person, but his role was equally culpable to hers, and they both profited from it and spent the ill-gotten gains.
The court also ignored, it is Mr. Bossier's position, that the court ignored the statements of the victims that seemed to support his argument that he was less involved. The court also didn't consider the genesis of the fraud.
I think that's a reference to the fact that the nuns said they didn't see as much of him as they did of her.
Correct.
Yeah, that doesn't diminish his degree of culpability, considering the nature of this fraud.
Isn't your biggest problem here that the standard is clearly erroneous? I mean, we can argue about whose role was what in this proceeding, and there are a lot of arguments one way or the other, but it's a little difficult to say that the judge's decision here was clearly erroneous.
Judge, that is certainly our biggest obstacle, yes.
I mean, these sentences strike me as quite lenient under the circumstances, given the degree of fraud and the nature of the victims in this case.
The court doesn't have any additional questions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Eugene Pietro.
Thank you. May it please the court. Gordon Giampietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States in this case. Judge, I want to start where you left off with the standard of review. Ordinarily, if you hide behind standard of review, it means you're not comfortable with the substance of your argument. I'm comfortable with both, but Your Honor is right. The standard here is this court left with a firm and definite conviction that an error was made below? I think given that standard of review and the facts in this record, the answer has to be no. The two real factual questions that Mr. Bossier raises here today are, one, I didn't see the victims as often as my wife did. And as we argued below, and I think the district judge correctly found, that was part and parcel of the fraud scheme. The lie was that he was too ill to meet with them, and that's why he wasn't there. So that factual argument is unfounded.
I have a little trouble, though, with this concept that he was participating as much as she because he stayed in the car, and she could say he was sick and so forth. Well, he didn't have to stay in the car. He could just be absent, and she could say he was sick.
Well, Judge, I think that's...
That proves a whole lot.
Yeah, the difficulty is this, though, right? As the guidelines say, the court is not required to take the bare assertion of the defendant with respect to his role in the offense. And the record is not clear as to what percentage of times he was with her and what percentage of times he's in the car as opposed to meeting with the nuns. And so the burden is on the defendant to raise and show with evidence in the record how often he was present, how often he did or did not interact with the victims, and there's no real evidence in the record with respect to that except his bare assertion that he wasn't there as much. Having said that, though, I think as Judge Sykes has indicated, that the relative culpability here is overwhelming. They spent $1.1 million roughly at casinos together. Where does he think this money is coming from in terms of his culpability relative to his wife?
Married. I mean, it's not unknown that one partner makes the money and the other one spends it.
Well, of course, she's unemployed at the time, so he has... She, of course, is unemployed at the time, so I don't think he had any expectation that she was earning this money legitimately. So putting that one factual issue to the side, you know, sort of the second one is the argument that he wasn't aware of the scope of her fraud. I think the difficulty with that is, I think it's inconsistent with paragraph 17 of the plea agreement, in which he agrees to relevant conduct that includes the entire scope of the fraud. I mean, the government has argued that that may be waiver, but I'll just say they're inconsistent factual arguments. On the one hand, I agree I'm responsible for the $1.1 million because it was foreseeable to me. On the other hand, I'm entitled to a role reduction because I really didn't know how big the fraud was. We would argue that even if that's not legally waiver, those are certainly inconsistent factual arguments. So I guess, Judge, again, focusing on standard of review here, there is no firm and definite conviction that the district judge got this wrong in terms of apportioning the relative culpability of these two defendants. There are these other interesting legal issues lurking out there, as Your Honor pointed out. Can you have an average participant in the two-person fraud scheme? The court's decisions in Gallardo and McGee suggest no, that you have to look at someone who's not a leader. So it's not clear to me that you can actually get a reduction under these circumstances. And the other legal issue lurking out there is the one I just mentioned about whether he waived this argument because of the fact that he agreed the relevant conduct included the entire scope of the fraud. But, again, if there are no further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
I have one. It's mostly curiosity. The victims testified, or at least there's evidence from them?
No, Judge, there were witness statements, victim statements, certainly, that were submitted to the probation
department. Is that all it was? Because I'm trying to figure out what it was that enticed them to continue to give this money away to these people, especially to her. What is, and that's mostly curious. It's so hard to believe that for 4 years they dished out, the nuns, I think, was about $840,000, and its priests another couple hundred thousand, and some others, I guess. But
well, I will say,
at least for my own edification, what the heck did they do that they were able to get away with this?
It is in the record with respect to the victim statements from the Pewaukee Carmelite nuns. In particular, the groundwork for this was as horrible as this. These nuns in Pewaukee were self-insured. They had been saving money since the 1950s to provide for their health care and their care in their old age. In essence, one nun in particular was very naive and very susceptible to her religious belief that she should care for her fellow man. And so when these defendants appeared on the doorstep Christmas Day, 2004, she subverted her distrust. She said, "This is my obligation as a Christian," and she went forward and started writing these checks.
One person made the decision all the way. Huh?
She requested, as I understand the record reflects, she requested some guidance from the superior in Chicago, I think, and was advised that these folks were nothing to worry about. There was no reason to believe that they were criminals in any way. Now, it is an extraordinary amount of money, and it's amazing that over this 3 or 4 year period, they wrote checks totaling $800,000. And we argued strenuously in the district court that they should get a vulnerable victim enhancement because we believe they were targeted because of their religious disposition. We lost that argument. We chose not to cross appeal. However, you're right, Judge. It's an amazing fraud, and I think it's really despicable because they targeted them because they were susceptible to this kind of, you know, plea for charity.
About that issue, it wasn't just charity to buy a meal or something like that. It was the amounts at issue were tied to the claim that the defendants were making, which was that they had large immigration legal bills to pay as well as large medical bills to pay.
Yes,
so
medical.
That accounts, I mean, it makes the story at least plausible.
Yes, medical bills for malaria and tuberculosis and other such things, educational expenses. You know, all the while the defendants have two apartments that they're maintaining, one on Chestnut here in Chicago. And so these are folks who are not sympathetic, but I think they chose religious institutions because they would be amenable to these sorts of pleas. And so, Judge, it's an extraordinary fraud, and you or I might not fall for it, but these contemplative or cloistered nuns, not really expecting that someone would target them in this fashion, you could see them writing these checks. It's a horrible crime. But I think to focus on the legal question before this court, there, you know, looking at this record, I don't think you can have a firm and definite conviction that Judge Kluvert got this wrong in terms of apportioning culpability. So if there are no further questions.
Well, are they going, where are they from?
Kenya.
Kenya? Are they going back to Kenya? Since they are, what do you call them, Assalese, or what do you call somebody?
They have political asylum, technical term. It certainly is a deportable offense. It's discretionary, my understanding.
Well, apparently she's not very popular back home either.
That's right. That's right. So
that may be the wrong kind of justice if they go back. Who knows? Maybe they'd rather spend more time in prison. I don't know.
Could be.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Euler, much time? You've got 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. I don't anticipate using that full 2.5 minutes. I would simply ask, I think it's important in this case for the court to overlook how offensive it may find the conduct in this case and look at what is a relatively narrow issue. And the government has talked about that the court can't rely on a defendant's bare assertions in determining whether one is entitled to this reduction. And at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Bossier's position was not based solely on his bare assertions, but was in fact coupled with the statements of some of the victims and the history of the offense and the genesis of the fraud actually back in Kenya. And in that regard, it is Mr. Bossier's position that the court clearly erred. The Pewaukee nuns accounted for approximately 73% of the financial loss in this case. And a majority of the solicitations did not occur in person, but took place through written correspondence or telephone calls. And the facts that the government has discussed here today, the separate apartments and the separate bank accounts, were what Mr. Bossier asserted allowed him to this to go on for so long without his knowledge. And it is his argument that the trial court really ignored that fact in making its decision. So with that, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Euler, you were appointed to represent your client in this case. You have the thanks of the court for your service to the court and to your client. Thank you.